What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Herring. Chris, I have two quick, slightly petty questions before we start the show. Number one, how are you doing? And number two, do you still think Giannis is the best player in this Bucks Nets series that has completely gone off the rails, or have you come around to Team KD?
Well, hopefully the first question isn't petty. I feel like you should be able to ask someone how they're doing.
Yeah, that was sincere.
I'm good, and I figured that question would be asked, and I think Katie has probably shut me up pretty good with that with that response. You know, it's interesting because I didn't think that they would go at each other a whole lot one-on-one, but clearly Katie had other thoughts, and quite frankly, you know, I think that has been one of the differences in the series. I mean, I think there's been obviously a pretty big margin in the games, but one, we weren't expecting Harden to be out. So, you know, maybe not thinking that KD would have to do as much as he's doing. But when he's done what he's done and been as aggressive as he's been and just kind of attacking him or Holiday or whoever else or Tucker, Giannis still has that hesitation of just taking over and, you know, seeing a wall and pulling up and then, you know, kind of just the wheels turning in his head. So that's been the next step for him for like the last year, 2 years, you know, 2.5 years at this point in the postseason is kind of, you know, does he have enough confidence to do what he should be doing? And the decision-making, you know, despite him not having the greatest jump shot, at certain points, you just have to take some of these shots. And quite frankly, you know, as easy as that sounds, at a certain point, it's not just taking them. You've got to make a decent number of them, and you're not going to have too many better shot makers that you play against than, you know, than KD. And so, you know, I think Giannis can be a bigger difference maker on defense, but if he can't stop KD in this series and KD is going to play the role that he's playing with this sort of usage without Harden, yeah, it looks like the tables have turned, you know, but at the same time, these are all-time greats to begin with. And so I just think the easier answer is, yeah, I was wrong on that. At least so far, I've been very wrong on that one.
Well, thank you for, you know, appeasing my pettiness and my immaturity. We have a lot to discuss on today's show. Before we get to it, I want to remind all of our listeners to keep the emails coming. Send all your thoughts and questions to us at openfloormail@gmail.com, and we will answer as many as we can in the days and weeks to come. On today's show, you and I, Chris, have a fun little exercise I thought of last night when I was, you know, looking at the remaining playoff teams and considering how many could actually win the title and just how, I guess, unpredictable this postseason landscape feels right now, at least to me. You know, I don't want to necessarily call it a toss-up because there are favorites, but it's pretty close. So what we're going to do is power rank all 8 teams from least likely to win the finals to most likely to win the finals. And it's something I'm very excited about, and I can't wait to see how you've ordered these 8 remaining teams. But before we do that, I want to open up the mailbag a little bit and answer a few questions that we were sent this week. The first comes from Joel, who writes, "Hey, Michael and Chris, with centers being more involved in offense the last few years and not just posting up in the paint, is Nikola Jokic poised to have the longest, less injury-prone career compared to other modern-day centers? It seems like most of these other big men just can't hold up throughout a season. Unlike Embiid and even the Cat or Adebayo types who have missed a decent amount of games the last few years, Jokic's game is not predicated on explosiveness or athleticism, which really seems to be the key to him staying healthy." Joel then goes on to say he trusts Jokic's body and asks if we're worried about Embiid's holding up for a lengthy playoff run. This was a very interesting email. Joel, thanks for sending it in, but I want to spin it into something slightly related that it made me think of. Off Joel's point about health and longevity paired with a body and style that doesn't seem to ever get hurt, Chris, how many MVPs do you think Nikola Jokic will win before he retires?
So I am going to take an extreme answer here, and I'll preface it by saying that I thought Joker would win the MVP last year before I came into last year saying that I thought he would win it. So I was a year early. I don't think he's going to win anymore.
Wow.
And here's why I'll say that. There was a really weird, and I think you probably felt this too, Michael, a really weird feeling around this one all year. I have said, going back to like the beginning of April, that we could stop having a serious conversation about MVP. It was very clear he was MVP. He's totally deserving. He's the guy I wanted to win based on the season he was having. You know, I think it should have been either unanimous or close to unanimous. What I'll say about that, though, is that I think for him, one of two things would have to happen, and I don't think they're either likely. When Steph won his first MVP, it was, you know, a great season that he had. His team was great. You know, they were already great. And then the next season, he kind of went full throttle, even, you know, based on what he'd done the year before, and the team was even better. I could see Denver getting better next year, but the thing is, we've already seen the Nuggets kind of vie for a number one seed in the West. So I don't know that they're going to have this breakthrough season that we've never seen from them before, the way that the Warriors did, where they were, you know, won 73 games or what have you. But the bigger thing, I think, is that look at what the conversation that we have around them now. We're talking about Porter Jr. maybe going down as one of the best shooters of all time. And, you know, hopefully at some point he kind of develops his the rest of his offensive game to create more for himself. You know, it may not be next year, but, you know, hopefully sometime soon we're going to get Jamal Murray back. And, you know, I say all that to say this. If guys make the ascensions that they're supposed to make, specifically Porter Jr., I don't know that Jokic is going to kind of be able to wow us the way, like to continue to take a step up. Like this was already a really big step up in terms of usage and efficiency and all sorts of other stuff, all career highs across the board for him. That's not to say that I doubt that he'll be able to repeat this sort of season, but if you're Denver, you may not want for him to have to repeat this sort of season because of what they were missing. So I don't know. I could very easily see this being like a Dirk situation where this is like a crazy, crazy year that he's had. I get that he's still relatively young. I get that his body is the sort that should hold up. But I also am of the opinion that, you know, because he's less athletic than everybody else, I don't think we should assume that he's going to play every game every year. And I don't know that you should even want him to, just based on the fact that, I mean, the league is still a very brutal place. And even if he's less prone to injury than other guys, the more you play him, the more likely he is to get hurt, not just him, but anybody. So I think it's a fantastic question. I think that the MVP question is kind of fascinating in this case too. But remember what I started with. There's been this weird feel around his candidacy in terms of the way other people are talking about. I think he's been deserving from day one, and that, you know, it was maybe a question between him and Embiid. But I don't know. I mean, like, it's just very weird the way that a lot of people seemingly have not embraced how great he is, or, you know, even the question, even like LeBron, that really cryptic statement he said about, we all know Steph's not going to win and we all know why. And, you know, it seemed to be like maybe not a shot at Joker, but just this weird undercurrent of something. And I'm not sure what it is. You know, maybe, and like I've wondered, like, is it a Euro thing? But Dirk has won it. I'm sure, you know, Doncic will win it at some point. You know, so it's not that. I don't know if it's that Joker is like more quiet or kind of more of an oddball in terms of the way he's perceived or what have you. But it's just a very weird sort of thing where I would really hate to think that someone's marketability or like lack of marketability comes into play. But it just kind of seems like there's something about him that people don't, it doesn't light people up the way it does with these other candidates. And it makes me kind of sad. One, that I can't put a finger on it, but two, that it seems like people, I won't say I have a problem with him being MVP, but it's like it seemed like it was like a last resort for a lot of people. And it's bizarre because he's so good and so fun to watch. So I hope he's in the conversation for plenty more. He's in an age where that should be the case. But I don't know, maybe just to make the argument too, I'm not completely sure he'll win another one.
I think that you made a really interesting point about how he's perceived, and I agree with a lot of what you said about how it's weird how he was kind of denigrated for a lot of the season. Now that he has won the MVP, though, and he has that in his back pocket, I think going forward that could change how he is viewed by the general public and, most importantly, media members who have a vote. I mean, when I looked at this question, it made me kind of think about the MVP award and the state of the award, in that it goes to, and we saw this throughout this entire season with the debate between Jokic, who did not miss a game, versus Joel Embiid, who missed 21 games, I think. And, you know, the MVP is increasingly unimportant, in my opinion, in a league that devalues the regular season. And so if you are going to compete every night, and I agree with what you're saying about how, you know, maybe the Denver Nuggets should rest Jokic a little bit more, and maybe playing him in all these games in this compressed season will have an impact going forward. Totally. He is so unique, though, that I could see it just not having a factor. I mean, I think about that postseason where against the Blazers, not this year, but in the past, when he was just like playing like 50-minute games, like the games that were going into overtime, he just wasn't coming out and wasn't getting tired. And the Nuggets play a slow pace, which is very unusual given, you know, that's not the strategy of that organization. They usually like to, in the past, have usually liked to take advantage of the mile high air and all that and play up and down. They have not done that over the past few seasons because of Jokic. And so my whole thing is, like, I would love to hear a case against Jokic winning again, or even winning like next season. I understand that, you know, Jamal Murray probably won't play. I'm assuming Michael Porter Jr. slides into that number two role. I'm assuming that Aaron Gordon gets a little bit more comfortable after a full off season and a training camp. But I think that Denver could be a one or a two seed next season. I think that they're just like built around this guy, and they all the pieces just fit so well around him, particularly on offense, that I could see them making a jump. I could see him playing in every game again, and this whole thing kind of just rolling over. And so, yeah, I actually would be surprised if he did not win another one. And that is kind of wild to say, because Kobe has won, KG has won, Shaq has won. Like, winning two MVPs is not anything to it's like, it's just really difficult.
It's
And
hard.
so
Yeah.
it's
And
extremely hard.
I think the other thing, too, that I didn't mention in my last answer, I mentioned it with Steph, and the idea that you generally have to win even more the next year if you're going to do it. And that's kind of what was happening with Giannis last year before the league got shut down, is that, you know, they were basically on a 70-win pace after, what, 60 games the year before that they'd won. So I think you got to win more, which that's possible to do, but like, keep in mind, they had Murray for, what was it, two-thirds of the season this year,
Yeah, up
more than
until
two-thirds of
April,
the
yeah.
season. And I know he wasn't totally healthy that whole time. And I know that Porter missed 10 games last year or this year, but you know, it's easier said than done. And it's when you consider that someone's carrying those sorts of minutes without Murray for a whole season. And yes, they've struck, you know, replacement gold with Austin Rivers and obviously other guys, Campazzo and everybody else has stepped up in a massive way. Obviously, Porter Jr. was great, you know, toward the end of the season as well. It's just a lot to ask of a whole season. He's absolutely capable. I think my other point to why I would maybe go the other way with it is that this has also been kind of a coming out party for a whole lot of young guys this postseason. And Devin Booker in particular, I mean, it's weird. If anything, it almost seems like he was kind of the, you know, the loser in terms of the Suns having this rise this year, and a lot of people attributing it to Chris Paul. Because if, let's say they had made it as, let's say things were flipped. Let's say the Lakers were the two seed, the Suns were the seventh seed, and the Suns just blow them out of the water in the postseason. Even, you know, because of Davis, without Davis, or whatever, however you want to phrase it. Let's say the Suns win that series the next year, and not only that they win that series, but then they're dominating Denver the way they are right now. If they were to do that the next season, I guarantee you, with the way Booker has played this postseason, I guarantee you he would be like a sexy pick for MVP. He may be anyway, but the storyline is kind of more sexy when you're able to kind of take someone that has come, you know, that was on a team that kind of came out of nowhere, that they were a seven seed one year and then they're a two seed or a one seed the next year. Booker basically did that this year, you know, where they went from being out of the playoffs for more than a decade to being a two seed and pushing for the one seed, and Booker wasn't really even in that conversation. So I, you know, Chris Paul was in the conversation in a way that I think was a little bit exaggerated and like overblown. But Booker will be in that conversation next year. And I kind of feel like the jump that we're used to seeing a lot of these guys make, Jokic included, standings wise, that it'll make for like a weird sort of dilemma with Booker. But I guarantee you he'll be in that conversation next year if he's healthy and has a good year. And really, you know, you could argue that the trajectory of it was thrown off by what happened this year. But anyway, I say all that to say, you know, that he'll be in that conversation depending on what happens with Atlanta and how good Atlanta is next year, that Trey will probably get more attention for some of that stuff based on the buzz that he's created. Luka will be in that conversation, you know, depending on what Dallas does this offseason and how good they are and what his numbers are like. So those guys are not going to be going away at all. So it'll be challenging for Joker, but like, absolutely, I expect him to be in the conversation. I don't know. Maybe that's just a shock jock in me, which I'm normally not that way, but I could very easily see him not winning another one. But if he does, like, am I going to be surprised? By no means will I be surprised. But I just think there's a ton of up and coming competition with guys that are going to be in that conversation just as much as he is.
This was not a shock jock take by you. This was nuanced. I appreciated it. I think about like someone like Anthony Davis, who should win multiple MVPs, but just won't because of the rigors of the regular season, which is just why I think that the regular season and just how we view it and what matters and what teams prioritize really needs to be reconsidered on a grand scale. Okay, so our next email is from Kevin, who writes, "Hey, Pod and Chris. With all the uncertainty about Portland and whether or not they should move key guys around, I have a trade idea. Kevin, we love trade ideas. What if New Orleans does a sign-and-trade with Lonzo Ball for CJ McCollum? CJ becomes an overqualified third banana in New Orleans, a fantastic shooter for Zion who can create his own shot when needed and has a bit of playoff grit and experience and leadership. As for Portland, it sucks to break up Dame and CJ, but an aggressive on-ball defender who can, it seems, hit shots and take some pressure off Lillard, isn't that a nearly perfect fit? It might be an overpay, but maybe there's cap logistics that can make this work. Maybe picks or prospects to sweeten the pot, but even then, which side needs to throw something in?" This is very interesting from Kevin. Chris, what are your thoughts on Lonzo Ball for CJ McCollum?
No, exactly. I mean, the Russell Westbrook meme, that's pretty interesting meme comes to mind. I kind of took down, we obviously went through some of this beforehand with your sketch of the pod today. I wrote down one question for the questioner, which I think it's a good question. It's an interesting idea. I'm horrible at trade ideas, so this is way better than what I would probably come up with on a first go. But the question that I raised, here was, oh, so New Orleans has decided they just really aren't ever trying to make a stop, huh? Because, I mean, if you're adding CJ to that nucleus, like, I expect that Zion will get better the defense at some point, hopefully soon. I know that you've got Bledsoe there that, you know, that has made an all-defensive team, but holy hell. Like, defensively, it's not making you better defensively. You don't have problems on offense right now. I get that, you know, it'd be better to get something for Lonzo than nothing. But yeah, and on the flip side of that, I think the challenge, and I discussed this on another podcast recently with Zach Lowe, it's really easy to kind of fall into the trap of thinking about fits for Dame. And obviously, I think from an X's and O's standpoint, Lonzo seemingly is great for somebody like Dame and Portland. Similar to New Orleans, they really need some defense over there. They've been brutal for, you know, what, 5 out of the last 6 years or something crazy like that. They've been bottom of the league all those years under Stotts, who obviously they'll be swapping out with somebody else. So X's nose-wise, it makes sense. You know, you probably play a faster pace than what Portland has by having Lonzo, someone that looks up the floor all the time on outlets and everything else. You know, you don't have to put Dame or anybody like that on. The better of the guards is in the backcourt and stuff like that, so he could do some of the dirty work. The frustrating part, and this is what I was saying to Zach, and Zach, I think, agreed, is that you can't really realistically put someone who is – I mean, I think it's fair to say that Lonzo's not necessarily a prospect anymore. I mean, he's beyond that. He's going to make real money, and deservedly so. But you can't put somebody like Lonzo next to Dame and expect Dame to be like, all right, we're set now. Like, all this is kind of relative to what Dame thinks about putting them in a situation where they're more competitive and that they're more able to make a run at a championship. And the challenge here is that I don't know that there's anybody that you can trade CJ McCollum for that really makes Dame feel that way. And that's the challenge. I think that's where we get into the domino effect of like, this situation, is it kind of so far gone that Dame might want out? And it only he can answer that question. Maybe it's a slightly premature question, but I don't know that you have like the nucleus right away that like either with him or Nurkic necessarily, that you find someone right away that like puts you over the top, that makes Dame feel like it puts you over the top. But X's and O's wise, I don't mind the idea of Lonzo there. I'm not sure what he'll make this offseason. I'm not sure of the logistics in terms of how feasible that is to do something like that with the sign and trade. But X's and O's wise, I'm fine with it. I just don't know that it convinces Dame that, you know, that he's more ready to make them a winner than CJ is. And obviously we've seen what the ceiling is with CJ is. So I, you know, they should be open to something like that. But I, you know, it's kind of all dependent on what Dame thinks and what Dame wants.
I think that the fit is, it's a more logical fit. Lonzo is a logical supplementary piece with just about anyone, assuming he's going to continue to hit 40% of his spot up threes. I also saw this as just, you know, straight up disrespectful to CJ McCollum, and I didn't even look at it from your point, the first point that you made, Chris, which was that it would just destroy New Orleans defense, which, yeah, sure. I agree with you. And they really need to figure out how to get stops over there. I was just thinking more about it from Portland's perspective, and this just doesn't make you a better basketball team straight up. So I think that that's where it gets tough here. And Lonzo, even though he's 6 years younger than CJ, I just think CJ, I would rather have CJ on my team, even on that contract. You know, if I was Portland here, I would probably like need something else from New Orleans too. Like I would ask for like Jackson Hayes or Kyra Lewis or one of those Lakers picks, and then the deal just dies. So that's kind of how succinctly I kind of viewed it. But we have actually another fake trade involving CJ McCollum, Chris.
Nice.
So buckle in. This one
Okay.
comes in from Marco, who writes, "I came up with a trade and would love to know what you guys think. Some of the picks could be reworked, but I'll let you be the judge." So in Marco's fake trade, the Bucks get CJ McCollum and Robert Covington. The Blazers get Chris Middleton and Kristaps Porzingis. And the Dallas Mavericks get Yusuf Nurkic, a first round pick from the Bucks, and a first round pick from Portland.
Wow.
And Marco goes on to explain his logic for all sides, including Dallas's incentive to clear cap space for the Mavs to build around Luka. Now, before you answer, Chris, right off the jump, I just have to say that it's very interesting. Cue up the Russell Westbrook meme. I think the draft picks here are a little bit of an issue, as Marco admits, since the Bucks can't trade any of theirs in perpetuity after the Jrue Holiday trade, and the Blazers owe their 2021 first to the Rockets. But you know, if the Blazers were willing to include two future firsts to get something like this done, I don't know if that would work. I mean, salary wise, I think it does check out. But all that, you know, as the preamble, Chris, what do you think of this absolutely monstrous fake trade that Marco just gave us?
Yeah, I mean, so again, props. I don't have the patience to try to sit and like I've never. I guess I'm a little young for the Tetris generation, but you know, I've never had the patience to sit through on you know the trade. What are they called? The trade, not trade calculators. What are they called? Man, I'm
Trade
old.
machine?
I'm young, but I'm old in the sense that I can't even remember what a trade machine is called. So shout out to anybody that has the patience to play with those and work with those. So my first thought looking at this is kind of like, man, it's a really optimistic viewpoint that teams are going to be willing to give up first round picks for Kristaps Porzingis. If anything, it seems like the opposite may have to be true there with Dallas. And I'm not even sure what their situation is. Obviously, they gave up picks to get Porzingis in the first place, but he has a lot of money left on his deal for someone who has been relatively injury prone over his career, who I think we're seeing quite clearly is not really a reliable, consistently reliable second option for a contender. So, you know, that's asking a lot to get two picks back for him, even in a cap clearing sort of situation. That was one of my thoughts with this. The other thought I had, and I don't know, like maybe we can get more clarity and the dust will settle a little bit. Two games from now, you know, if Milwaukee is fortunate, maybe I guess 5 games from now. But Chris Middleton, you know, for as much as he struggled in this series, you know, up to this point, he'd had a really good postseason. He won a game for them very clearly. I don't know that Milwaukee – I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what sorts of changes Milwaukee wants to make if they get smoked here in the second round the way that is happening right now. Because at this point, it'll be clear that you probably need to shake up something, especially if Harden is not back and they just get swept, you know, with 2 out of the 3 stars from Brooklyn. That would suggest a lot. Maybe they are ready to move on from Middleton at that point because you just got Holiday and just spent everything you had on Holiday. I can assume that Giannis probably would not be thrilled about that, but you got to do something. I mean, the other question that I think that is interesting here is like at a certain point, how much longer do you rock with Budenholzer? You know, it's
we're
crazy.
In the days. We're in the days. Answer for that question, I think. Honestly, it's looking very bleak.
I mean, but it's like a crazy sort of thought because this to me would be the closest thing we've seen to like a Thibodeau firing. You know, with Chicago, where it's someone that wins a ton every year and has his team in the conversation every year. I mean, even more so than Thibodeau because, you know, the Bucks have been healthy enough to make a run every year. But, yeah, I mean, at a certain point, maybe you've kind of gone as far as you could go. You tweaked and overhauled the offense completely. You brought in, you know, maybe not a star, but as close to a star as possible without being a star, whatever you consider Holiday to be. So maybe Middleton is the next, you know, thing you look at. But, man, he fits really well with Giannis in the regular season. He has value in the postseason, but this – like I said, if he continues to struggle in the series and they just get swept out of the series with 2 of the 3 Brooklyn stars, maybe it is more of a question than what I thought. I was not even considering that possibility before the series of them moving Middleton. But, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it is feasible. I think that the picks would have to be reworked. And like you said, you'd have to look through it a little bit more carefully because a couple of these teams don't even really have the requisite picks to trade anymore because of how much – they've thrown at their future with right. Drew and, you know, and Porzingis in the first place. So we'd have to see what would come of it, but yeah, it'd be fascinating to see what you get for Middleton because he's paid like a top guy and he's, you know, again, if we're seeing somebody kind of fizzle out as a number two option with them, it makes you wonder kind of what teams are going to be willing to throw at you to make him their second option if he's not working out as your second option. So it's a very fascinating question, I think.
I think that you're right to really focus in on Chris Middleton. He's the best player in this trade. There's a lot of really good players in it. He's the best one. Before I kind of get into it, what you said about Bud was really interesting because it's funny to like think about. You remember like when Jason Kidd was let go and there was like the Doug Collins to Phil Jackson parallel there where it was like, okay,
yeah.
Bud is going to be the Phil Jackson here. He's going to take Giannis to the next level, to the promised land. And now it's like, Bud is the cap. Bud is the ceiling. And where, like, it's just, it stinks for them a lot. And I don't think a lot of people foresaw that relationship fizzling out as quickly as it potentially will here. So when I look at this trade real quick, it's kind of fascinating for just the fact that if you're the Bucks, like you have, I don't want to say have to, I think Chris Middleton's really good and he's played just atrociously in this series so far. Mm-hmm. And we're recording it before on the day of Game 3. So if you're listening and Chris Middleton went for 40 in Game 3, do not send us any emails, please. but he's the only piece that you can, like, I don't think you're going to move or shop Drew Holiday. That wouldn't make a lot of sense to me. So I think that Chris Middleton might be the guy who is shopped to upgrade that roster if they feel like they need to go back to the drawing board. There's you know, it's possible that they just think the head coach is the problem, and that is also a possibility. And then you just kind of roll it back, which would be, like you said, a very tough pill to swallow if you actually are swept or lose in five to a team that doesn't have one of its three best players. That would just be devastating for Milwaukee. This one doesn't, I don't think this is going to happen, because if you do trade Chris Middleton, there's more stuff that you can get for him, I think, than basically, like, CJ McCollum and Robert Covington are good players, but, like, if you mash them together, they're kind of Chris Middleton.
Exactly. So, yes, exactly.
Yeah, so I don't know if that makes you better. And I can just picture teams kind of targeting CJ a little bit in the playoffs. So, yeah, I do like the idea of Dallas clearing cap space, and, you know, they're in a little bit of a pickle here as well in trying to build around Luka and not turn that into a LeBron Cavs situation, which would be really sad. But this was a fun fake one. So thanks, Marco, for throwing it at us. Okay, Chris. So I teased it at the top. The main topic for today's show, you know, this power ranking of the eight remaining teams from least likely to win the title to most likely to win the title. And, you know, I think this is pretty self-explanatory. I don't need to set it up anymore. So do you want to start with your number eight? Do you want me to start with my number eight? Why do you want to proceed? I'll let you decide.
It doesn't matter. Why don't you start? Because obviously you're lobbing you're lobbing these questions at me repeatedly. So why don't you start, and then I'll just go with mine.
Okay, super. So my number eight least likely team left to win the title, I don't think this is a hot take at all, but it's the Atlanta Hawks for me.
Okay.
I love the Atlanta Hawks, and speaking as an objective journalist, which I like to think I am, even though I'm probably not, I'm rooting for them pretty hard, to be honest. Like, I think Trae Young's awesome. Watching Bogdan Bogdanovic get into the playoffs and actually show us what he can do in games that matter has been a thrill. Kevin Huerter is, you know, potentially going to get like a max contract.
When is that dude up? Because that dude, like, every, and I try really hard to, because I've watched him plenty, so it's not like he's just on my radar screen. I'm trying really hard to not look at him and just be like, man, that white dude has so much skill, but, and like so much athleticism and everything else. But every time I watch him play, like, he surprises me with something more. And it's so fun to watch that. When is he up? Because I'm not good with contracts and memorizing contracts. When is his deal up?
I'm going to look that up as we speak.
Well, I'll do it, because you were in the middle of an answer. I interrupt you. Go ahead.
Okay. So yeah, like, when I, real quick, on, we're not going to spend, you know, 20 minutes on Kevin Huerter, but the way I kind of view him is, and since this is since he was drafted, he's just like, he's not as good a shooter as Klay Thompson, but he's a very good shooter. He's just not one of the greatest shooters of all time. But he's a better playmaker, and he has the size, and he works on the defensive end, and he's able to punish mismatches as he's gone at Seth Curry in this series and had a lot of success. So he's just a really good player. I mean, they should start him, I think. Solomon Hill, I don't really understand those minutes. I think Nate McMillan is actually coaching a really good series, but I would just like to play Kevin Huerter a little bit more if I was Nate. So yeah, like, you know, Atlanta just doesn't have a chance to win the title. I mean, it's like, I think, frankly, it's a testament to Travis Schlenk's offseason that they can even be here without DeAndre Hunter, without Cam Reddish. Like, those are the two building blocks besides Trae Young when you look at this whole roster and you're like, these two, you would imagine that those two are contributing at a high level for them to get as far as they have. Those two are, I think Cam, I don't think he's been ruled out for the playoffs, but he hasn't played in a very long time. DeAndre Hunter just had knee surgery, unfortunately, yeah. A huge bummer. So, you know, this series right now is tied 1-1 against Philly. The Hawks have absolutely no answer for Joel Embiid. If Joel Embiid is able to play big minutes with that, his own knee injury, as he has in the first two games, I just don't see Atlanta kind of coming back there. So, shout out to Atlanta. I think their future is extremely bright, but they are the worst team, in my opinion, remaining, and I don't see them winning at all.
So I went slightly different here, and based on your reaction from the first question that you threw at me, well, I guess the second question you threw at me aside, the third question aside from how are you and are you ready to sound, you know, to admit that you were stupid the last podcast with saying Giannis is better than Durant.
I would never call you stupid,
Chris. You didn't phrase it that bluntly, but I'm just going to go with it just because it's more fun to say it that way. So the third question you asked me was, did I think Joker would win another MVP, basically? And so I have Denver last here.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I have Denver last, and I think it's more of a statement about Phoenix than it is about Denver. I already felt really good about Phoenix going into the series in a way that was probably like the most confident I felt about a matchup that a lot of people would have deemed to be a slight toss-up or maybe like a slight – maybe Phoenix was like a slight favorite going into it. But I felt – you know, I probably would have like put 85% odds on like Phoenix going into the series because – I don't know. We've all probably watched them play enough. Maybe clearly not all of us, but like I think a lot of us that take pride in watching a lot of the games and stuff like that. Phoenix just they didn't dismantle the Lakers, but there were times where they kind of came close, you know. And I think people already favored the Lakers in that series to begin with because they're the Lakers and they're defending champs and they've got two superstars, you know, even though they were both hobbling, coming off of injuries or injured, whatever you want to call it. So it became really easy to kind of write off Phoenix's win for a lot of folks by saying that, well, the Lakers weren't totally healthy and everybody outside of LeBron stunk that was healthy. And Drummond was playing and Gasol, they didn't know how to really integrate certain people, whatever. I didn't watch that series and see that. I felt like the Suns were actually just the better team anyway for long stretches and really put their foot on the Lakers' throat when they had opportunities to do it. And you know, that their bench looked really good. Cameron Payne looked really good. You know, that Ayton looked incredible, even, you know, by the standards of just saying how well he'd really improved over the course of the season from last year. And that doesn't even speak of the fact that Booker had, like, I won't say an all-time great closeout performance, but he was lights out in the last game of that Lakers series. So, you know, and that was with Paul still kind of working his way back from whatever the shoulder issue was. Move into this series and we've kind of seen Jokic play fine. He hasn't been great, but he hasn't been bad by any means. He's been fine. And, you know, after game one, I even said this during game one, after game one, I was like, this just kind of feels like a performance where Ayton is essentially, and they said this on TNT several times, but Ayton was essentially matching what Jokic did. And there's literally no way for Denver to win this series if anything close to that happens. You know, over the course of the series, when Phoenix has all these other weapons, like Ayton is, I mean, you could maybe say he's the second most important son in this series, given that, you know, the defensive responsibility he has with Joker. But I mean, okay, if he's able to be anywhere near what Jokic is doing production wise, good luck with trying to win that series without Jamal Murray, with Porter Jr. not himself, and, you know, and with Barton just coming back, like, welcome back, Will Barton. You know, this is what you've got to go up against. So I don't know. I feel really good about Phoenix. It's all about Phoenix for me in terms of why I don't really trust Denver. And I'm one of the biggest Joker supporters you're going to find as far as just how good he is, how great his ability is. I think this would be a really amazing series if you had a full-health Jamal Murray there. You know, Barton had been in a rhythm and back playing in a rhythm. But I just don't see it. And I didn't really see it after game one, let alone what we just saw in game two. Maybe stuff shifts a little bit when they go back to Denver, but I just don't see it. I Joker would have to play out of his mind, And I think you would probably need one or two other people. Maybe you need Morris playing more along the lines of the way he played. By the way, your story on Morris earlier this week was incredible. I loved it.
Thank you. Apologies to Monte Morris's family for totally jinxing him. But
I mean, I'm, at least he had the story out. Now it would be too late to run it just based on what we're seeing from Denver.
Yeah.
I just don't. You would need a couple of really unheralded sorts of performances from these guys that I don't see it at this point with all the stuff that Phoenix has to throw at them. I really think I don't see why Phoenix shouldn't be favored to come out of the West. And I was like walking the line of that viewpoint before. And, you know, for those of you that heard me on Zach Lowe's podcast last week, I kind of was hinting at that. I was very clear in saying that I thought that they were much better than Denver this series going into the series. I kind of towed the line of saying that I thought that they'd come out of the West, but you know, if they can stay healthy, which is a huge thing with Chris Paul, obviously, and anybody else, I don't see why. I mean, with the way that they're playing, and granted, I think there's a talent disparity at this point, but I really do like them. I really do think that they could come out of the West and maybe even should come out of the West. They've been this way all year. And I think people are treating it as if it's a fluke because of the injuries. They're basically talking about them the way that people talked about the Lakers last year with the injuries and everything. But, you know, this is how good they've been all year. They played like this all year. They've been locked in all year. And it seems there's something about their urgency and the urgency they play with that I just kind of see it for them to take the next step and maybe get to the finals. So we'll see. But I'll put Denver eighth because of that.
Okay, so Phoenix is excellent. You're spot on there. I had Denver as my number six team, and, you know, my rationale there is basically, like, I agree with you. I think it says a lot about Phoenix and how impressive they are, and, I mean, their offense has broken Denver's defense through the first two games, and I don't know how Denver can make adjustments with the pieces and the personnel that they have. Like, they've blitzed, they've dropped Jokic, they've switched on the perimeter, and Chris Paul and Devin Booker and campaign too have completely just decimated everything. So I don't know how you fix that. And then offensively, you know, look, when in the start of game two, I kind of foresaw DeAndre Ayton getting into foul trouble and that being the key to Denver winning that game, and it happened. And then they just didn't go at Saric really at all, or even go at Ayton after he picked up two and Monty left him in for an extra couple minutes, which was just a humongous risk.
Yep.
And there was one play where Aaron Gordon had the ball in transition, and instead of just stopping the play and going back out and giving the ball to Jokic and letting him attack Ayton, you know, he takes this push shot that bricks and Phoenix goes the other way and hits a three in transition. And possessions like that just speak to how, like, every possession there's humongous value in the postseason. And I think that you can't afford any mental errors when you're going up against this Suns team with Paul and Monty and just so much intelligence. So Jokic is going to have to average like 40. Like, he's averaging 23, 11, and 5. Right now, that's just not going to cut it, straight up. So he's going to have to be superhuman. He's going to have to embarrass DeAndre Ayton, get him in foul trouble early. And, like, all those pieces that you mentioned, got to step up. Michael Porter Jr. doesn't look healthy. He's got to, like, I don't know what the solution is there. He's got to average, like, 25 a night. Like, it's just, it's going to be really tough. It's an uphill climb. The reason I have them sixth and not eighth is I still don't 100% count them out for making a comeback, because that's just what Denver is. They're super plucky. They believe in themselves. They've got a lot of grinders on that roster, a lot of second round picks and whatnot. So I don't think they're going to quit. Michael Malone has called them out basically already. So we're going to see what happens in game three back in Denver. So that's why I had them sixth. So for seven, though, my seventh pick is the Milwaukee Bucks. And, you know, again, as we record this, the Bucks are down 0-2. And we're, you know, this is all what are we looking at right now in this moment in time? So they could win tonight. They could blow out the Nets for all we know. And then my tune would probably change a little bit. But right now, I mean, they have, like, you know, I look at the Nets defense, and the Bucks are letting the Nets defense turn into the 2004 Detroit Pistons. Their offensive rating is 97. They're trying to isolate on every possession. Giannis is taking these pull-up threes that just, I thought he was done with this, and he's just not. And I have negative faith in Mike Budenholzer right now to figure out how to score, let alone figure out that or realize that you can't drop Brooke Lopez 35 times against KD and Kyrie Irving and Joe Harris and all these guys. Like, it's just not going to cut it. So I do not think that the Bucks are going to come back and beat a team that I think is the best team in the NBA right now. And who knows? Also, James Harden could play if this series were to stretch out to 5, 6, 7, James Harden comes back, and then it just makes it that much harder for Milwaukee to win. So Milwaukee's my 7. Who is your 7, Chris?
Yeah, I went back and forth on whether I wanted to have Atlanta or Milwaukee 7. So we're not lockstep, but I ended up putting Atlanta 7, partly because I think DeAndre Hunter and not having him in this series really hurts them. Not having him at all. It sounds like it won't even be the series. It's just the rest of the postseason. It's hard to imagine them, even if they were to get through a series, it's hard to imagine them having anything for Brooklyn in the next series if they don't have him. I mean, even if they did have him, it would still be an uphill battle, a huge uphill battle. But I ended up putting them 7th. I think they can still win this series. It becomes very easy to see them win this series if Joel Embiid, you know, if something more serious happens with his knee, or if he decides to run at random Hawks players and, you know, almost, you know, push them, punch them, what have you. I couldn't believe that he almost did that last game. I was blown away by that. And like, people, I've said this a couple times on Twitter lately. Like, I think I have a really nice, friendly reputation on Twitter. I think I'm a very nice, friendly person in general. I'm losing a lot of patience with people that view stuff through like a binary lens only. Because people are like, how did you want him to react? Because who was it? Was it Gallinari that had pushed him?
Yes, it was earlier.
And they're like, you want Joel to just take it and not do anything? I said, there's a difference between not doing anything and running up on the dude like he said something about his mother. Like, and maybe Gallo said something about his mother. I don't know. But you like, the idea of running at that dude like that, like, it actually looked like he was going to fight him. And that would be the biggest win for the Hawks at this point. I mean, Trey is fantastic, but it's very clear that Embiid is the best player in this series, even at whatever percentage he's at. He's not even fully healthy, and they don't have an answer for him. And so you need to just kind of safeguard him. And the other thing I was frustrated about watching that is just thinking, like, man, Embiid is playing this series with a partially messed up meniscus and is able to play through it and dominate through it. And so, like, the crazy thought of what if he ends up having to sit out the rest of the game because he gets ejected. He's already beaten the odds by being able to play on like a messed up meniscus, and he's about to potentially get ejected for like going at a dude who pushed him a little bit. Like, come on. So anyway, I say all that to say this. The Hawks have a very real chance anyway. You know, something could flip. I do feel pessimistic given that it seems like the Sixers found something, which I think a lot of people would have tried to begin with, which is just to throw Ben Simmons or Thibault on Trae Young more consistently instead of using Danny Green like they did in game one. But, so I feel a little bit more pessimistic. Like, I don't think it's, you know, a sizable gap between the two teams the way that I think a lot of people came in thinking there would be. But I do think not having Hunter makes it more sizable. And I do think that the Sixers probably found something that works here. So I have them 7. I have barely the Bucks in front of them at 6. And that's more of just a respect thing for Giannis, but I don't see much that the Bucks are doing that suggests that they're going to be in a better spot as far as, you know, I don't know how they turn this around based on what we know about Budenholzer and based on how little resistance we see the Bucks actually kind of presenting Brooklyn with. So maybe something flips, maybe they get a game, but I mean, it's one of those inevitabilities at this point, because like you said, Harden could potentially come back at some point. And if they're already struggling to defend the two of those guys, what happens when you've got a third? So it's crazy to think about them.
Yeah. So your kind of analysis of the Hawks and why you had them down there leads me into my number 5 team.
Okay.
And that is the Philadelphia 76ers. I don't know what it is. It's Embiid's knee as well as he's looked. I just do not, going back to our first question, I just do not trust his body, honestly, holding up, particularly against the Nets or whoever comes out of the West, I think is going to be a really difficult matchup. So I think Embiid's body, I'll start there. And then I just am not a fan of, once you get past the starting five, that bench, I don't trust anyone coming off it, really. I think that there's a lot of specialists, but a lot of flawed role players on this roster. And like, if you are reliant at home in, I don't want to call it a must-win game two, but that was a pretty competitive game until Shake Milton came in and just started hitting all these threes. It's like, on one hand, you can look at that like with the glass half full point of view and say, oh, look, like we have this guy who's a microwave off the bench. But on the other hand, like you should have taken care of business and blown out the Hawks, honestly, in that game, especially with Embiid playing as well as he did and Simmons guarding Trae Young as well as he did, especially like from the jump, just picking him up full court. I thought that Simmons' defense was tremendous. And so I don't know, man. Like the Hawks' strategy of just abusing Seth Curry, I've said this already, no matter who was on him, they just targeted that matchup. And, you know, there was one stretch in the game where Herter's on him and Herter is just going into the post. And then they move Danny Green onto Herter and they move Seth Curry onto Bogdan. And then they just feed Bogdan and Bogdan goes right at Seth Curry. So I think when you have that disadvantage in your starting five, it's tricky, and I don't know who they would slide in. If you want to slide in Thybulle to take care of the defense, then on offense he really hurts your spacing. Spacing is critical to this team because of Embiid, because of Ben Simmons. And so I just think that they are I don't think that George Hill at the deadline was the answer for this team. And so I've been skeptical ever since then. I thought that if they got Kyle Lowry, even if they gave up Maxey and Danny Green or whoever to get him, I thought that that would really elevate them to true title contender status. Here, I look at the roster and I just see these holes against a team that they should be humiliating, frankly, and they aren't. And so it makes me weary.
I hear you on that. I think, like I said, we're not lockstep on this, but we're pretty close. I put the Clippers fifth and
Oh, wow.
had Philly. I had Philly fourth. So I mean, we're not crazy off, but that said, and I think maybe I've said it to you. If not, I've said it on Twitter. The Clippers are unusual for a lot of reasons because I don't think I've ever seen a team lose the first two games of a first round series at home, mind you, and be a lot of people's favorite to still win the whole thing. You know, you could make the argument that by doing that, you've shown that you're resilient and that nothing can really shake you up at that point because you've already kind of been up against the wall as, you know, in the worst spot that you possibly can be. But, you know, the weird part about it to me, though, is that, you know, they got through that series. Obviously, they were up against an unusual sort of opponent. Luka might be the biggest wrecking ball, you know, maybe I would say maybe aside from KD with the way he's playing right now, in this postseason. And so you can make the argument that even if you really had a rough go of it in the first round, you made it through it, you got out of that round. And now maybe stuff is a little bit easier. You can breathe a little bit more. All of a sudden, you can play a couple of your guys that really weren't part of the rotation in the first series with Beverly and certainly using Kennard more than they were able to when they brought him in toward the end of the last series. But what I'll say is this, my concern, as close a game as that was in Utah the other night, you can make the argument that that was really the game of the postseason so far. My concern is that Utah was playing without Conley, one, and two, that Utah went as cold as you can possibly. I mean, they basically had a Houston game seven performance in the middle of their game, and still came out on the winning end of it. Doesn't mean that you're out of it, but that feels like kind of anything that can go wrong will go wrong sort of situation for Utah, and they still won. And they still have more kind of reinforcements coming, you know, assuming that Conley's not out of it. So I don't know. That probably made me a little bit more cynical about the Clippers than I otherwise would be. Doesn't mean they're out of it. They still, you know, people still have them as a favorite. I get it. It was a road game, so I get it. But that probably restored some of my faith with Utah in a way that I didn't expect to really have done at that point. And made me a little bit more concerned about the Clippers just because that's a really, I can't think of too many cold spells that I've seen like that where a team still comes out and wins, let alone when they're shorthanded to some extent. So
Can
I put,
I
Please go
Can
ahead.
I jump in? Can I jump in really quick and just defend my Clippers? Because
Sure.
I have the Clippers number two here.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so this is where I guess we diverge pretty dramatically. And I'm not gonna chastise you for putting the Clippers where you did. You're probably, you're thinking with your brain, I think. Like, I'm just this blind believer in Kawhi Leonard. I will follow him wherever he takes me. When I looked at game one, the cold spell, you can't deny. Conley not playing, you can't deny. I mean, there's a couple things here. First of all, they're coming off this game seven that was, or seven game series, I should say, that was just physically, mentally taxing.
Sure.
PG played like 44, 45 minutes or something in that game seven and game six. Kawhi's playing a ton of minutes. He's guarding Luka. Those two only were able to play 26 minutes together in game one. You factor that plus Donovan Mitchell, like the team went cold. Donovan Mitchell was not cold
Good
in the
point.
fourth quarter there. And
Good point.
so I think the quick, easy adjustment that Ty Lue could make, and I wonder if he's kicking himself, is why did I not sub out Luke Kennard in the fourth quarter and just put in Terrence Mann, who is a much better defensive player? And every single possession was okay, we are hunting Luke Kennard with Donovan Mitchell.
Right.
So I keep going back to that as why I still have faith in the Clippers coming back. And I really love how they embrace their small lineup, even though their small lineup did not have a lot of success in game one. I just think it was carryover from that first round. And the team that gives me so much faith is, I keep going back to the 2014 Spurs, and the parallel, this is a really weird parallel.
That
But
was the
that
one where they were down
team,
2-0 and against was it Oklahoma City?
well, yes, that is true. But what they also did was barely beat a Dallas Mavericks team in the first round,
Right.
in a seven-game series a year after the Ray Allen shot. So the resiliency, I think, is huge here. And so I want to give credit to Kawhi, who's a proven winner. And was a part of that Spurs team. And I don't think Paul George will shoot as bad as he did going forward, even though there's all these stats out there that, he's basically the worst shooting star in playoff games in NBA history, if you look at your Twitter timeline.
Yeah.
But I still have a little bit of faith in him. And I love the shooting. I love the fact that they can go small and not lose anything on the defensive end. I love the fact that they can play Zubats when they need to, and he's very good. They just have so many options. So I love their talent. I like their coaching staff's ability to make adjustments. And so that's why I have the Clippers number two. But I 100% hear everything. I'm not going to lie and say I'm like very confident in them. They could lose their next two games and it wouldn't stun me. But for right now, I still am a Kawhi believer.
Okay, that's totally fair. And hey, man, like looking at his game seven alone, or just kind of the way he played in game six, game seven of the last series, and just knowing what he's done in the past, there's still so many guys that, I think about whenever I watch a guy make like an incredible jump, and we've seen a few of them in the last few years now, but Jimmy Butler is one of the first people that comes to mind, and then Kawhi is one of the others where I still remember that year that he was in the MVP conversation for the first time. It's like, where the hell did this dude come from? Where, he makes like a quantum leap in terms of his ability as an ISO scorer, just kind of overnight, seemingly as good as he was, and as much of a defensive talent as he was, and like a good fourth, fifth scorer to go from that to being a top line guy that can just score and just rip the ball out of people's hands. And then not just that, but then, during that run with Toronto where they win the title, he leads them to a title, the passing ability. So look, I won't ever blame someone for not counting Kawhi out. I don't quite think I'm counting him out, but you could kind of read it that way. Just, when we have eight teams and we're power ranking them and I say that I'm putting them fifth, I think it really, for something like that, it almost is kind of more of a question of which team are you putting in that fifth spot? For you, it was Philly. For me, I think the only reason I have Philly higher here really is that Philly has a they're in a situation now where they've evened their series and they look like they figured something out, versus the Clippers being down 1-0 with one more game to go on the road before they get back home. And, you know, close game. It wasn't like they lost by a lot, but there were some things there that, like I said, between Conley and the cold spell that Utah, obviously they got a ton from Mitchell, an absolute ton from Mitchell, but that's a game that, you know, the Clippers, I'm sure they would have really liked to have had that game given some of the things that played out during it with not having Conley and the cold spell. So, but yeah, I think you could very easily flip those teams, or you could have Utah a little bit lower. And depending on who you think wins that series, you would think the Clippers might be higher than Utah if you believe the Clippers will win that series still. So I get it. I had them 5. I put Philly at 4 for the reason that I just explained to you, that I feel like they figured something out with how to guard Young more effectively than they did. And obviously the results showed, spoke for themselves in Game 2 versus what happened in Game 1 with Danny Green, which I still don't quite get that logic. I guess it doesn't matter now if you figured it out. But yeah, I mean, Philly, it's hard for me to put them any higher than 4. One, just based on the fact that, you know, they're going to have a wrecking ball to play against in the next round, assuming that it's Brooklyn. And the fact that, you know, they're not quite out of the woods. You know, if Embiid gets hurt, you know, Simmons really has not done a whole lot. You know, last game, what did he take? 3-4 shots in the last game. So he hasn't really done much of anything on offense. Curry played his, you know, shot out of his mind the last game. As you mentioned earlier, Shake Milton was a huge revelation off the bench. But like you said, that bench is inconsistent. Doc wasn't even really utilizing him before that outburst. And so it's really easy to see how, as much as I want to kind of say that Philly figured something out, that might have just been kind of a one-off, a one-game scenario. The only consistent thing that Philly has had and has shown so far is that Embiid is the best player in the series if he's able to play at this level with this level of health. If he's not, then everything is on the table and all of a sudden Atlanta's right back in the series. You know, so I wouldn't put Philly any higher than 4th and would fully understand if you or anybody else had the Clippers in that spot or had the Clippers even higher than that spot. But I put Philly at 4 in mine.
All right. So all understandable. I have no beef with any of that. So my 4th, we can kind of zoom through the last teams here because we've covered them, I think, earlier in this conversation. But my number 4 team is Utah.
Okay.
And this is the first team on this list that I can really seriously picture winning the title. Like, I can't. I honestly, barring, you know, whatever massive injuries impact either team's competing, I just can't get there with Denver or Philly or Milwaukee or Atlanta right now. Utah, I can see, especially after they're winning Game 1, I can see them winning the championship. I just think that, you know, this is them all year. They've been one of the best defenses, one of the best offenses. The way they move the ball, the way they penetrated against the Clippers' small defense and forced them into rotation, even though the Clippers should be switching, was very, very impressive. And if they're able to keep that up throughout the series, then they'll win, I think. The one thing I keep going back to, and I don't want Jazz fans to get upset at me because I'm going to write about this later or next week, I think, and it's about Rudy Gobert's defense. And just the obviously, I have all the respect in the world for him. I think he deserved Defensive Player of the Year. I'm just curious a little bit how he would do against Chris Paul, who has diced him up in past postseasons, Devin Booker, mid-range assassin.
Yep.
You look at the Nets, assuming the Nets get to the finals. That is a very tough matchup for Rudy Gobert defensively. And in this current series, honestly, if they start hitting, I mean, Rudy's still dropping. He's not really up to touch that often. Kawhi went at him fearlessly, I thought, at points in Game 1, in the paint even. So I think that some of the criticism is overblown, and I don't mean to add to that here with what I'm saying, but it is something that I look at and I wonder about when you kind of just consider the relatively limited nature of his ability on the defensive end.
Yeah, no question. I've mentioned this before and talking with other people that I've was a little bit surprised that like seemingly no one had Phoenix as a favorite in these conversations, which to me was on its own wasn't strange, but my thought was that if you can potentially foresee a scenario where they're playing against the Jazz in the Western Conference Finals, I would probably pick Phoenix for that very reason. That I think Phoenix potentially is the toughest team that the Jazz would play for exactly that reason, that they're comfortable taking shots that generally the Jazz are okay with surrendering because they're, uncomfortable from an efficiency standpoint for most teams, but not for the Suns. And that's my thing is if they play against each other, I really like Phoenix in that matchup. They matched up well during the regular season, played them extremely competitively during the regular season. Maybe the best game of the regular season between those two teams for the whole 2021 campaign. So I really like Phoenix if they have to match up with Utah. I think you could make the argument that maybe the Clippers turn out to be, a tougher matchup for a team like Phoenix. But yeah, so for that reason, exactly what you just said, I give Utah at least a slight nod here over the Clippers and over Philly just because they're in a situation where they're in control of their series, at least for now. They might have more coming back with Conley. I put them at three. I have Phoenix ahead of them for exactly the reasons we just said. And Brooklyn, which I got to give it to you, man. You wrote about this before. You explained it, with a pretty clear throat, without really a whole lot of throat clearing last week, where you were kind of stunned that I was taking Milwaukee in the series. Similar to the way that, before the first round started, that when I said that I thought that Knicks Hawks would go seven, I was like, you were like, I've got Hawks in five, and I thought you were insane for doing that.
A broken clock is right twice a day, Chris. It's
Well, but
okay.
I don't know, man. It would be more like, well, I would say lightning striking and you pointing out the spot that it was going to hit or something. Maybe not quite that crazy, but I would say more so for the Hawks Knicks series. I think you were one of the only people I saw picking that series in five games or fewer, either way, either direction. I probably should have seen more of this coming with regards to the Nets, because like I said, if you're potentially just wrecking the Bucks with two of your big three and and not even needing the third guy, which that's what this has been so far. Even if this doesn't end in a sweep, you could argue that it would have had it, had the Nets been at full strength, if it ends up going five or something like that, and it's a gentleman sweep. So yeah, at Brooklyn, it's hard to not view them as a favorite just because they theoretically, you don't really see who's going to come out of the East, the other side of the bracket, that looks a whole lot tougher than what they're facing right now with Milwaukee. Maybe the Sixers, but Embiid is going to have to play lights out, and he can, potentially he can do that. But even then, I mean, it's just we just mentioned before how Simmons really isn't even shooting much in this series. They'll have more defensive options maybe than Milwaukee does, and I think this is a series where DiVincenzo would be nice. I don't know that he swings the series at all, but it would be nice to have him certainly. Philly has more to offer defensively, but I don't know that they're going toe to toe with what Brooklyn can do from a scoring standpoint, especially if Harden is back healthy enough to participate in that series and play long minutes in that series. So it's hard not to have Brooklyn at the top of the power rankings. I'm sure you probably have them there in yours as well.
You are absolutely correct. I have Phoenix number three, the Clippers number two. Real quick on Phoenix, I don't think we've said this yet, or at least I didn't. They have the best defense in the playoffs right now, and this is a I don't want to start a whole new conversation here, but Ayton is this revelation that's taking the postseason by storm, I think. And what is really interesting to me is we might look at that draft when they pass on Luka Doncic, and if they win the title this year because of Ayton, like, that was the right pick. And it's really fascinating to me, like, how that could be possible when Luka is this generational talent and Trae Young is this generational talent in his own right. And Ayton is just, he was the number one overall pick. He is playing out of his mind. He is neutralizing the MVP of this season. And what Ayton looks like in 2 years, in 3 years, is truly terrifying. So I just want to quickly shout him out. I already talked about the Clippers at two, and then you're right, the Nets I have number one, pretty easily for me. You know, in writing these outlines, I like to jot down some notes for myself. I didn't jot down anything for Brooklyn. They have the best player in the world in KD, who is just, I think there's, not to rub salt in how I started this episode, Chris, but I just think there's a gap between him and literally everybody else. There is no watching him try to get defended by PJ Tucker is, it's like, it's like we need to double. It's you're in trouble with this guy. He is totally unstoppable. And right, they don't have Harden. Blake Griffin was left for dead, and now he's probably going to get a mid-level. Like it is a wild basketball team. I don't even know what else we can say about it. They are historically great. Chris, do you have anything else to say about any of these teams, or are we good here?
No. I think we're good. I think we've ended up covering them, a couple of them twice, just through, my rationale on why I have them ranked in one spot and you where you've got them ranked in another and why. And so I think we've kind of covered it and appreciate, like you said earlier, to the folks that submitted questions too. I thought those trade ideas were cool. So it was cool to talk to you guys.
Yeah, awesome. So that'll do it for today's episode. Thanks so much, everybody, for following along. As I said at the top, and as Chris just said, feel free. We really love all your emails. Keep them coming. Send them to openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Thanks again to you, Chris, for your wonderful insight and for indulging this exercise that I came up with at like 11 p.m. last night. I will be back on Monday with Rohan. You and I, Chris, we will be back next week. Until then, everyone have a wonderful weekend and continue to enjoy these NBA playoffs. Whoa.